The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it's nice to be sitting with you again on Sunday morning. I've been gone for over a month now, and most of that time I was teaching a month-long retreat at Spirit Rock, and that's very much still with me, that experience. It's a, for some people, it's an event of a lifetime to be able to go off for a whole month away from work or family or normal life and be able to go on such a long retreat. And it's quite a powerful experience to be there, both for the people who are sitting the retreat and also for the teachers and all the people supporting it. And it's a silent retreat, so some of you have never been on retreat. Perhaps it's unimaginable, the idea that you'd spend a month in silence without talking. There's a little bit of talking, and that about three times a week there's a short 15-minute interview with a teacher talking about your practice. And then occasionally there's a little bit of talking around. Everyone has a job, you know, for 40 minutes or something, of washing dishes or doing something, chopping vegetables for lunch. And so there's sometimes a little discussion that goes around, you know, you should cut the carrots this size. But otherwise, it's pretty silent. And my wish would be that anybody who has not sat such a retreat, if you can't sit it, my wish, if there's some way to organize it, is to somehow allow you to kind of walk into the meditation hall in the third week of the retreat for 5 minutes. Just stand in the back and feel it. Maybe we could have, you know, tours. We'd have, you know, meditation tour buses. We'd drive up there and get you all ready and quiet so you don't disturb the, and we'll kind of step into the door of the meditation hall. And because it's such an amazingly powerful experience to feel the pristine stillness. And there's something about that stillness of people who've been sitting for a long time that feels so clean and beautiful and powerful. It's stiller than almost anything you can imagine. It's the stillness that's kind of alive with a certain kind of power. It, you know, nothing much happens on these retreats. I mean, you know, mostly what people do is they sit in meditation like you did. People walk in meditation, do walking meditation. They might do this, you know, chop the vegetables, you know, or clean dishes. They listen to a Dharma talk. But otherwise, you know, really nothing happens. And so for some people, it's very foreign to do something where nothing, you know, for a whole month, nothing's going on. You would think it's boring. Now, occasionally boredom does surface, but it can be one of the most important experiences of some people's lives, because what it allows is a meeting, a confrontation with oneself. And it's like you put a mirror to yourself, and you really see yourself and highlight when you're not busy doing a lot of things, if you're not busy with a lot of socializing and talking. There's so many ways in which our active life, or semi-active life, keeps us, because we're engaged always in doing things, it makes it harder for us to see ourselves in some deep way. And when the normal kind of activity of daily life, and the normal way in which the mind is activated in daily life, quiets down enough, so we're not so outwardly directed or preoccupied by things, we see ourselves in a deeper, more clearer way. And that is a, and so whereas, so that because nothing happens, it allows a lot to happen, because it allows us to kind of then meet ourselves, know what goes on within us, and know it in a deeper way than you can ever imagine. And in that process, having to contend with what you know, having to deal with what you see, what's going on here. For some people, that's a process of wrestling with their demons. And other people, it's a process of wrestling with their angels. And some people, it's dancing with, you know, sometimes it's, you know, it can be quite a challenge, but the challenges themselves, which are inevitable, open up the door to something more profound and more beautiful. If nothing else, it opens up to the possibility of being at peace, having the mind settled enough, so it's not engaged always in the process of fixing and making and doing and defending and building a self and planning the future and, you know, defending the past. Just kind of be in a peaceful place. It's not easy for the heart, the mind, to find itself in a profound experience of peace. And so one of the things what you see on the long retreat, you don't have to be on retreat to see this, but you see it in kind of a deeper way, is the degree to which our hearts, our minds, are not really at peace. And sometimes the way people live their daily life makes it really difficult to see the agitation or the conflict that the mind is operating on all the time. So to confront that and then be able to move beyond it, confront the agitation, the clinging, the holding, the grasping, the fear that's operating, the desire, the greed, and then to go beyond that and experience ourselves in a much more deeper place that can't be met if it's covered over by greed, hate, and delusion, covered over by agitation and preoccupation. I think it's a really courageous thing to go on retreat like this, and I'm very respectful and in awe of all of us who go do that and are able to kind of meet themselves in this deep way. It takes a lot of courage to be able to sit and look deeply at what goes on within and to be able to move through that. Now, to simplify or kind of get the essence of that process that goes on retreat or in Buddhist practice, it's a process of coming to non-clinging. As long as the mind clings, it's going to suffer. And to find a profound experience of non-clinging is kind of the direction that the practice is going on these retreats. And non-clinging is not, might not seem like a sexy spiritual goal. Non-clinging is a very odd thing because non-clinging, it doesn't exist. It's not like an existent thing. Like, where are you going to point to non-clinging? I mean, you can point to, if I'm clinging to something with my hand, you can point to that fist that's tight around it. But non-clinging, you can point to an open hand, but is that non-clinging? It's just an open hand. Non-clinging is not a thing. And so when the mind is always concerned about things, it's sometimes very hard to appreciate the absence of a thing, which is non-clinging. Even though non-clinging is this phenomenal opportunity for the heart, the mind, to shine, to let the most beautiful parts of the mind to come through. There's a ancient record, supposedly, of the Buddha's disciple Sariputta. I guess the Buddha asked someone came visiting from the Buddha's home country. Buddha was not living there, but someone came. The Buddha said, "Oh, is there in my home country, is there any monk or nun who has really plunged to the depth or the fullness of the spiritual life, really realized in some deep way?" And the traveler said, "Oh yeah, there's such and such a person, this monk." And one of the Buddha's disciples, Sariputta, heard this, and he said, "Oh, someday I hope to meet that monk." So it happened. Much time later, he met that monk, and so he was going to—I don't know if he was going to test him or not. Find out what was kind of a Dharma discussion. What was his understanding? Since he was so well realized, what was his understanding? And so Sariputta asked this monk, "Is the purpose of living the spiritual life to attain great virtue, perfect virtue?" And the monk said, "No." And so Sariputta said, "Oh, is the purpose of the spiritual life to attain concentration, perfection of concentration, to really get the mind fully concentrated?" And the monk said, "No." "Is the purpose of the spiritual life to overcome all one's doubts?" Seems good, right? "No." "Is the purpose of spiritual life to have great knowledge, and vision, to really see things as they really are. No. So then Sariputra said, well, what is the purpose of this spiritual life? And the monk said, to experience release through non-clinging. To experience nirvana through non-clinging. To not cling. And then Sariputta was happy. So there's all these wonderful things that can happen in spiritual life. To attain great states of virtue, of concentration, of knowledge and vision, understanding. And those happen along the path, but they're not the purpose of the path. The purpose of the path in Buddhism is to attain non-clinging. To have the experience of the heart and the mind released and free. And so, a little bit, this is shorthand, a little bit this kind of Buddhist kind of way of talking, to use this kind of language of non-clinging over and over again. Some people don't understand what it means. But it's not such a foreign idea to other spiritual traditions. I wanted to read a passage from Master Eckhart, who's a Christian mystic from some hundreds of years ago. And Meister Eckhart said this, I have read many writings, both by the pagan teachers, I guess that's maybe the Buddha, by the pagan teachers and by the prophets, to find which is the greatest and best virtue with which a person can most completely and closely conform to God. And as I scrutinize all these writings, so far as my reason can lead and instruct me, I find no other virtue better than a pure detachment from all things. So that's interesting. So he uses this translation uses detachment. Buddhists don't like to use the word detachment in English because it's associated a little bit with kind of aloofness or indifference. In Buddhist English, we like the word non-attachment as opposed to detachment. But here, Meister Eckhart talks about the same thing, non-clinging. Not cling to anything as being kind of the ultimate goal of, he says, all the spiritual traditions that he could encounter back in his time. When I think of the Buddhist path, sometimes I think of it as, think of it as going up the mountain. If you're hiking up a steep hill, there's a gravitational force that's pulling you down. And so it's a lot of work. And so, but if you get to the top, the peak, and then start going down the other side, it becomes easier because you're going down. And then gravity is helping you. If you go up, it's against you. If you go down, it goes with you. So the Buddhist path is kind of like a mountain, and going up a mountain. And as you're going up to the top of the mountain, that half of the path, the gravitational force that you're contending with is the force of clinging. And the stronger the clinging, the harder it is to walk up that mountain. Once you get to the top and over the little hump and start descending the other side, the gravitational force that's pulling you along is non-clinging. So it's very common to use the metaphor of going up to the top of the mountain. And some people feel like the top of the mountain, it's their metaphor, is the goal. But it's only halfway in Buddhism. And sometimes to change the metaphor, the other side is sometimes described as being like floating on a river. At some point, the gravitational force of non-clinging, the current of non-clinging, you catch it, like you're catching a wave. And it becomes easy. The path becomes easier and easier because you're kind of going in the direction where gravity is pulling you, towards freedom. And so it's quite a turning point in people to feel that difference between the life that's being directed by clinging, by desire, by attachments, by need, sense of neediness, that I need to have this, addiction when it's quite strong. Versus a life that's guided by the experience of the heart at peace, at ease, at rest. So non-attached, a heart that's non-attached, that's not clinging to anything, not grasping to anything. A heart that doesn't need anything, but the heart that's being guided or led on its own to an experience of freedom. And to really feel that difference. And so on retreat sometimes, a person can kind of cross that threshold for a while, where you feel that no longer are you contending and struggling with the gravitational force of clinging, but now you're releasing, surrendering yourself or allowing yourself to flow with the pull of freedom, of non-clinging. And that's what has the greater value. But it can be a lot of work at first to go up the hill and to encounter, to deal with all the things we think are so important that we hold on to. We hold on to our opinions of what's important. We hold on to the past. We hold on to the future. Amazingly enough, some people hold on, they cling to their suffering. I can let go of everything, but I can't let go of my suffering. Because my suffering defines me. It's how I find my identity. It's how I find my relationship to other people. Without my suffering, who would I be? Some people hold on to their roles they have. Some people hold on to their needs. I need to be in a relationship. I need to have security. I need to have different things. Some people hold on to their fears. Some people hold on to their neurosis. Some people hold on to all the different ways in which they define themselves or ways that society has defined them for you. And they hold on, I need to be this way and to be seen this way. And so there's a lot of contending with all these different attachment and needs. Some of them have to do with traumas and incomplete kind of forms of development as children who grew up. That the children have very powerful needs that need to be met. But if they aren't met, then go into adulthood carrying those needs, and they take the form of very powerful attachments. And so we have to contend and work with that. And slowly we begin to let go. And the process of letting go is a mystery to some people. How do you let go? And I'd like to offer you an analogy. Sometimes I give this analogy for at the beginning of retreats. I learned the analogy when my son was in preschool. And they played with beeswax. And they'd get to, it was kindergarten actually, I think. So in kindergarten. So they get to kindergarten, and the day, once a week they did beeswax work. And so the first thing the kids were taught was they took the beeswax, and it's hard and cold in the morning. And you can't do anything. It's very brittle. It's really hard. You can't do anything with it. And the first thing they do is they put it inside the palm of their two hands. And they hold it there, and usually the teacher then would tell them a story. And as they held the beeswax in their hands, their own warmth would soften the beeswax until it was soft enough that you could begin kneading it, working it. And so once you could knead it and start working, you start kneading it and working it and kind of softening even more until it's soft enough and malleable enough, wieldy enough, that you can shape it into something beautiful. And then once you have something beautiful, then you'd put it up on the shelf in the kindergarten. You'd release it. You wouldn't hold on to it, right? But you'd put it someplace. So in the same way, when we come on retreat or meditate, it's often good to think that the first step is not to attain anything or do anything. If you sit down, you're going to try, I'm going to get concentrated here, I'm going to just bust through. Your mind is like that cold beeswax. And a lot of people, try so hard when the conditions are not really there, because the first thing that's needed is you just need to relax, lighten up, soften what's going on. And so in some way or other, to do the equivalent of holding yourself in the palms, in your warm palms. So often the beginning stage of practice has a lot to do with finding some way, just finding to be a little bit easy, be at ease with what's going on. Don't fight yourself, don't fight what's going on. Some teachers like to emphasize acceptance of the present moment. Embrace what's going on. Don't be in conflict with what is. Hold what's going on in the kind gaze of your inner eye. Even if what's going on is bad news and it's challenging and difficult, can you relate to it in a soft, kind of loving way? Can it be a kindness? Can it be a compassion? It's okay. Don't get pulled into it. Don't get lost in that inner world of thoughts and agitation and concerns and fears and desires. but just to kind of be hold it in the hold it, be very present for it. The idea of learning how to be present for something without fighting it or struggling against it is one of the big learnings we try to do in this practice here. And the same time as holding it without fighting it, not giving into it either, not having it run the show. So you might get angry, and so you might so how to hold the anger with kindness without giving into the anger and without trying to fight the anger, just being present for it. And sometimes we need a long period of time of this kind of accepting presence, just be with things, allow things to be, and learn what it's like to just have that kind of equanimity, that ease, or that calm with experience. And that allows something to soften, to warm up. And when the mind stops being brittle, when the mind stops being hard, then in Buddhism we talk about the mind becoming soft, wieldy, and malleable. And then when the mind becomes softer, then the mind can be shaped. Then you can do something with the mind. You can shape it into something beautiful. The mind is, in Buddhism, the mind is not a thing. It's a process or series of processes. It means that whatever state your mind is in now, it doesn't have to be that way forever. So some of us, when we look at the mind, our mind can seem quite fixed and hard and solid. Our preoccupation concerns can be so tight, so claustrophobic in there. It just feels like I'm stuck this way. I'm depressed and I'm going to be depressed forever. Or, you know, oppressed and this is the way things are. And so as we kind of relax and soften, then we can begin kneading it, working it, the mind, and making it softer and softer. And part of the process of developing concentration, coming back to the breath, mind goes off, come back to the breath. I liken to kneading the beeswax. Of course the mind's going to wander away. You don't have to be upset about that. Your job is to push back into the beeswax, into the mind, by just gently coming back to the breath, and trying to stay longer and longer with the breath. And as you do that, it begins to soften more and more, because when the mind has a free rein to stay in its preoccupations and concerns, it reinforces a stuck mind, a tight mind, a preoccupied mind, a habitual mind, a mind that's caught by its habits. But there's an inner sense of compulsion. There can be a very powerful compulsion in your mind. Anybody meditates, right? Discovers compulsion. I mean, you haven't been meditating if you haven't noticed that your mind's out of control. it said that meditation really begins, mindfulness practice really begins when you can no longer do the instruction. Isn't that nice? You come and listen to someone like me and gives, you know, instructions, hopefully good instructions, and you know, oh, that sounds good, I'll do it. And then, I can't do it. Congratulations. Because when you can't do it, that's when you start really meeting yourself. Because the really important part is to see where it's difficult and why it's difficult, what's going on there. And probably what you discover, there's compulsion. There's addiction to thoughts, addiction to concerns. You can't let go. Mind is preoccupied and wants something, it's desire. There's resistance, and it's very powerful. And so so the mind keeps wanting to go into its concerns. And if you say no, thank you, and bring it back to the breath, then the food, the energy of the mind, is feeding concentration in the breath instead of feeding a preoccupation. The attention is kind of like a food. And wherever attention goes, you feed something about what you pay attention to. So if you're paying attention to greed, desire, hate, fear, there's some way in which that gets reinforced. But if you step back from it and don't invest your attention in it, then it loosens and softens. And if it doesn't get fed and reinforced, it begins to relax. So keep massaging yourself back, coming back, kneading back to the breath, coming back to the breath, slowly begins to take the food away from our preoccupations. And this is one of the reasons why simple breath meditation is used for stress reduction. Because you're no longer kind of feeding the condition for causing stress. So we're kneading, you know, coming back, and the mind gets softer and softer. And then as it gets softer, then we turn the mind into something beautiful. And one of the ways the mind gets more beautiful, there's a variety of ways, but is to begin following the pull or the path or the flow, the current of non-clinging, of not holding on to things. Non-clinging brings a phenomenal amount of beauty, and it brings freedom. That is the most beautiful thing of all. You know, if you take a fist, make a really good, thorough fist, half your hand disappears in the fist. And not only is it it's the best part of your hand for most people, it's the soft part of the hand that can feel something and shake someone's hand or caress a young child on the cheek. The soft hand that can be soft part of the hand that's sensitive and attentive to what goes on and can do all kinds of fine, beautiful things. You can write letters to your friends or whatever. But if you make a fist, you can't do. You know, the best part of the hand disappears inside the fist. When we cling in the mind, in the heart, the best part of our life disappears inside the fist of clinging. The sensitivity, the dexterity, the ability to respond and sense and feel disappears in our mind, in the mind that clings. When the heart or the mind opens its fist, then the sensitivity that allows compassion, empathy, kindness, generosity, all has a chance to come. It's much harder to happen if the mind is closed down. We lose half our life, at least, when we cling to things. And we regain it all when we let go. And it's a hard lesson to learn because people think that, because there are things we need, so we think, well, I need to cling to those things. But the very thing that, the clinging to it destroys it. Someone once, many years ago, wrote a beautiful poem on a retreat, I think, and passed it on, of catching a little bird, like a little injured bird, picking an injured bird up from the ground or something, a little chick or something. And that poem had to do with, if you hold it too loose in your hand, then you know, it'll fall and get hurt again. But if you hold it too tight, you damage it. So how do you hold it just right, softly? How do you hold yourself just right? Hold the needs, the things you have to engage in your life. How do you hold it so you don't lose your life by squeezing too hard, or lose your life by letting it go? So on these retreats, it's a phenomenal place where people meet themselves and where they can discover, be involved in a process of a thorough process, a very deep process of coming to the other side of clinging, seeing it very deeply, softening around it, coming to the other side, and experience a stillness and a peace that is one of the most beautiful things that is available here in this life of ours. If I could take you on the Dharma tour bus, you know, you'd probably, you know, the experience of stepping into that meditation hall, it's kind of like maybe the experience of going up in the high Sierras in a beautiful spring or summer day and seeing a beautiful, peaceful alpine lake, completely still, see straight down to the bottom of the lake, it's so clear and still, just peace, just lots and lots of peace. And the point is not to just taste that peace, you know, externally. The possibility is to experience it within. And when we experience it within, then at some point, hopefully, we can turn it around and offer it to others as well. And others can share in that. So I can't really give you, you know, create the Dharma tour bus business for you that takes you other places for it. But IMC is a Dharma tour bus into your own hearts, I hope. So, you have any comments or questions about anything that I've said or anything you'd like to ask?
When does love for your children become clean?
When does love for children become clinging? When you suffer. I think if you're suffering, when there's a sense of compulsion, when there's expectation, so one of the really important sources of suffering is a clinging to self, self-identity, self-image. And some parents, that's a huge thing to contend with. The suffering around their kids is not the attachment to the kid, but attachment to what we think we're supposed to be like as a parent. You know, you go to the store, right, with your little three-year-old, and the three-year-old has a temper tantrum. You know, and it makes, you know, it's you know, the temper, you can deal with that at home, but in the store, the whole world sees what a terrible parent you are. Who allowed you to be a parent? And, you know, so there's a whole self-image thing comes into play, you know. And it might have nothing to do with you as a parent. It's just, who knows what goes on sometimes with these kids. And but it's an important question. I don't have, you know, the final word on it, answer for you. The interesting, important distinction with is between what can be called bonding and clinging. Or in modern psychology, they have a word, they use the word attachment very positively. Whenever you hear the word attachment or non-attachment, you have to step back for a moment and say, who's using the word? If it's a Buddhist, then you should translate the word to craving or clinging. If it's a child, someone is a child psychologist, you probably translate it into bonding. My wife, when our first son was born, when he was a baby, she joined an organization called BAP, Bay Area Attachment Parenting. And there it was all about how to create this healthy bond, this healthy connection between child and so there is something that goes on, that bonding process, which is different than attachment, that has its own, but the bonding has its own need, its own kind of laws to be followed. But even there, if you suffer, suffering, we say in Buddhism, arises from the clinging. So I don't know if that helps at all, but if you want to ask again?
I think that helps. I have to think about it more. But what you consider the desire to protect them from harm, form of clinging, or is that?
I think so. There's all kinds of appropriate and necessary, I think, appropriate desires that a parent should have. If a parent doesn't have these desires, sometimes it can be problematic for the kid, right? You know, parents should want to feed their kid good food. Parents should want the kid to have a good night's sleep. The parents should want the kid to feel loved and feel safe. There's a lot of things that the children really need developmentally to have, and the parent should have that. That's a primary responsibility of the parent. And so part of the art of living is how to follow through in the roles and the responsibilities we have, but without clinging to the outcome. So we do the best we can, but the best we can sometimes is not good enough. And so do we add insult to the difficulty by suffering on top of it? It's unfortunate. So, for example, I don't know if this is a good example, but part of my responsibility is to make sure my kids have a healthy school environment and healthy, good teachers who treat them well. But it turns out that there's a couple of kids, teachers in my school, in my son's school, that seem to have kind of an anger problem. And you know, it's school's dealing with it somehow, and it's unfortunate. We try to deal with it best we can. But you know, I could get neurotically kind of attached to, oh, my son's going to be ruined for life, and this is terrible, and, you know, and I'm not following through my responsibility, and it's up to me, and I have to kind of neurotically kind of ride every possible hint of what's going on, and email and call the school all the time, and, you know, that's one option. The other option is to kind of do what's reasonable, and to realize that, you know, I think maybe it's good that my son has to experience this kind of issue. Because it's kind of a, sooner or later, he has to learn how to be wise around angry people. Learn how to contend with that, you know, to have some immunity to angry people and kind of not, you know, to know how to know that terrain. And so we do our best we can, but perhaps, you know, I'm kind of roaming around here, but I think my belief is that what's important for children is they see that we're doing our best. Not necessarily that we're successful, but they feel the intention there. And if we don't, so the love there, the care is there. And then when things don't work out right for them or for the family or anybody, then I think it's very helpful for the kids to see that we don't suffer. We don't get afraid or get angry because they're not working out. And so we try to take care of things. They break their leg, and that's unfortunate. And then we don't get all kind of flustered and angry or frightened. But we say, "Oh, let's take care of this. This happens. Let's go and take you to the hospital." And do they feel a certain ease or a certain kind of I don't know if relaxation is the right word, but. They feel the lack of anxiety as we do the best we can to respond to life. That we don't suffer because of it unduly. Yes, another parent.
Hi. You're talking about clinging and how half the world disappears when we grasp. And I can start to grasp at really trying not to cling. So it feels counterintuitive to relax into just experiencing the clinging, not reacting to it, but just experiencing the clinging, the grasping, the compulsion, and trying to get a sense of softening
right.
around that. Could you speak to that?
So you're saying that you have some intuitive sense of the value of non-clinging, but now you're clinging to that.
I can sense myself grasping. I know I'm, yeah. I'm compulsive. My mind is compulsive right. about certain things, and it's not yeah. a comfortable feeling.
Yeah.
And so I really want to grasp at not feeling that.
Right. It's okay. I mean, it's all okay. And if you're practicing mindfulness, you'll start noticing the patterns of what drives your life, what drives you. So you describe one of the patterns. And so part of the function of mindfulness is to highlight and see this really well, and don't be in a hurry. But as you see things really well, there's kind of a lightening, loosening up, the freedom that comes with that. And perhaps the first step of that freedom is simply that you're holding the beeswax in your hand. You're simply, oh, look at that! Here I am grasping again. There's such a strong tendency for me to grasp, and my habit is to now get angry with myself. But instead of doing that, getting angry, let me see if I can bring kind of some kind of acceptance, some kind of just offer a kind presence to that part of me, or bring some compassion to that part of me that's always grasping, even for non-grasping, and just see that and hold it with compassion for a while. Maybe a while means a long time, until the heart learns a different lesson.
It's so wonderful when it does release and you sense so much of the possibilities that are out there.
Yes, and it's very common for people then to grasp again. This is great. And so, you know, it helps if you have a sense of humor, you know, about it all. It helps even more if you have a sense of compassion for it all. And it helps a lot if you're patient. And it helps a lot if you realize that you're on a path that takes a while to really work through, and you know your ongoing process you're involved in. And it's a path that if you follow well enough and thoroughly enough, will lead you to a place that can sound very, very, very frightening. And that is a place where you let go of everything. Including yourself. And I wish you well. And I hope that you know how to hold. I hope you have some warm hands. So, thank you all.